So I think we're going to do this with a little bit of back and forth. We've got a couple of mics here. Oh, that looks exciting. Just a moment.
Yeah, there we go.
All right, so I'm not the Fonz of electronic media. I won't try hitting anything more to make it work. Before we get started, I just want to say very briefly that this is not a project that Nick and I did. This is a project that Nick and I did with a lot of other people, some of whom we've never met, but some of whom we have. One of whom's names you find on the back here, Michael Crumpton, is the person who did all of the visual work for the book. I mean, created all the pages, touched up all the images, etc., etc., etc. He's really a co-author. And then there are about five people at MIT Press, including Doug Seary, Catherine Innes, Michael Sims, so on, who spent literally years working on this project with us. And they're the unnamed co-authors who you can't find anywhere on the cover. But it's certainly not just our project.
And they even had other books to worry about.
So maybe I'll just spend a couple of minutes introducing things before handing things over to Nick for a bit. This book makes an implicit argument. The implicit argument is that history, technology, art, and critique matter for new media. It's not a very controversial argument in this room, I'd imagine. So we won't spend very long talking about why we made that argument. Instead, we'll talk a bit about how we went about making that argument. So one way, the most visible way when you pick this thing up is through these 825 pages of reprints. And they're reprints of things written from the mid-1940s to the mid-1990s. There's nothing more recent than the mid-1990s. Which for some people has been kind of dumbfounding, but we really view this as a foundation. We view this as making that argument that history matters to understanding what's happening now, instead of the most recent excited article out of the equivalent of Wired for whatever the moment is. So there are a lot of names that people in this room will be familiar with, Doug Engelbart, Ted Nelson, Alan Kay, the Bush who has come up in various guises today, but also other things. So selections from catalogs. So there's selections from the catalog of the first major art, or arguably the first major art and technology event that could be considered part of new media, the EAT Nine Evenings, software, the first time that we can really think of people being invited to interact with computer art instead of just seeing art produced using a computer. And so various things like that. And then, of course, a lot of groundbreaking critique by names that cross boundaries, like Norbert Wiener, who's come up, and ones that are more firmly on, one side of the fence, like Langdon Winner, et cetera, right? A number of you can see the table of contents and see all the horrible mistakes we made in making our selections and to take issue with us later. But what is most important, as Matt said, is the part that's less visible. What's most important in the context here is the part that's less visible when you pick it up, which is this thing that's kind of hidden in the back flap, and where we often get asked, so that's where I can find the searchable text of the book, right? And in fact, no. It was impossible to get the electronic rights to put the text of the book on the CD. And so there are a couple of things that we got the electronic rights for, and we put them up on the website for you to download. But there is no text of the book on the CD. The CD is for born digital objects and documentation in other forms than text. So for instance, there's a video, and we're not going to talk very much about the video, but that mother of all demos is documented here, and other things connected to Stuart Brand, like the Architecture Machine Group projects that he wrote about in a different book. But finally, let me turn it over to Nick to start talking about some of the things that really are born digital.
Yeah, the CD contains really the primary sources for investigations in new media. We can read some very provocative theory and criticism that's been developed over the years, but the objects themselves are what we want to engage with and what we want to look at. And the other thing is, frankly, they're what we enjoyed in the first place. That's what excited us. The reason that, and I don't just mean Noah and I mean I think everyone in this room is interested in this topic, interested in this field, because we saw things about electronic literature that stimulated us, that provoked us, that made us believe that the computer could provide literary experiences. And you know, just one of the things that we're going to be doing actually is sort of, I think, bringing us down to a very concrete level of what in this case was an editorial process, not an archival process, of putting together a bunch of material so that other people can experience it, so that other people can actually interact with this and understand what these objects are, you know, in direct interaction with them. And we want to do this, just you know, in part to be able to study this material, but also because we like this stuff. This is what made us interested in electronic literature. This is, you know, we want to engage with this material, and we want to be able to look at it further ourselves, and we also want to be able to share it with other people. So perhaps it's good to start in on looking at a few of these concrete examples.
Or should I talk about those issues that kept coming up?
Yeah, I mean,
or
you know,
they're obvious, maybe.
No,
yeah.
Well,
or is it a break?
Let me. I guess the first thing would be to mention some general matters with regard to the CD. We made some choices overall to, for instance, create it in valid XHTML 1.0, to use CSS, and to put it in an ISO standard format so that it's not only readable on a Macintosh or a Windows computer, but pretty much on most things nowadays that have CD drives, Linux, FreeBSD, and other systems. Not all the media is accessible on every possible system, but you can at least look at the descriptions of these different objects that we have, and you know the material is there. On different platforms, and we tried to make it as available as cross-platform as possible. You know, the other thing is that we had some of this material is available for free. Some of it was made available only for us to publish on this CD, but in anticipation of the Creative Commons, we decided to include a copyright notice at the bottom, which is in the small print that characterizes these sorts of notices. And explains, let's see here, you know, basically gives you a pointer to the terms under which the different works are offered. So here it says at the end, see the README for information about redistributing Space War. And this explains that the program itself is in the public domain. You should provide this credit paragraph to be distributed with all versions of the program, which I guess is legally contradictory because you can't put conditions like that on work that's in the public domain. But that's we decided to follow their instructions and put that paragraph in anyway. And so these are some of the ways that we dealt with the overall issue of how to make this CD as available as possible right now and over the future in the next few years. So if you want to talk about some of the issues that that we encountered, that'd be a great way to frame this.
Yeah, so we're gonna get down to showing you specific examples soon. Not that how my boyfriend came back from the war and the sound with it is not a great example, but I think it's, you know, gonna be fun to have a few more that we throw around for the rest of our time together. So let's see. None of these are going to be a surprise to the people in this room, but one of the issues we came up against was how to get permission for putting things on the CD. Another was, how do we actually get a file of that thing we have permission for? So if someone says, yes, you can use my thing, but no, I actually don't have a good version of it for you to put on, which is something that happened more than once, yeah. Then how did we find something that was appropriate, you know, and maybe crack screens are really cool and things like that, but maybe we wanted to find something that was relatively close to the original version.
We wanted to have a gallery of crack screens, actually, for the... but and no one knows what this is, I think.
Well, people know what cracks... Are there people who don't know what crack screens are? Oh, great. Okay. So, take it away.
This is digression number one. So in the, say, mid-1980s, in the era of home computers, pirated software was distributed on bulletin board systems remotely, but also people would just get together and copy disks. And typically the properties of specific disk drives, like the ability to read slightly better than the disk drive could write, things like this, were exploited in various Byzantine ways to make it very difficult to duplicate the data that you had on a disk and still have it work, you know, in a running format. So people would then crack this copy protection to allow the program to be duplicated easily. And when they did this, they would often add a screen. They would always add a screen at the beginning, you know, taking credit for cracking the work, which would go along with the program wherever it went. So.
This was before the digital millennium copyright.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, another piece of culture that we've lost to the DMCA. We've lost it in other ways too. But so once we'd gotten permission and we had a file that we would want to put on the CD, then the question was how to actually make this work run on a modern computer, right? How to make this accessible? And the problem being that these are not documents that happen to have interactive properties from our point of view. These are computer programs that happen to have some of the features of documents. Is really the way we came to look at it as we were working on this project.
And I mean, in general, I'd say one perspective on electronic literature is that it's new media production that you happen to read, as opposed to some other activity like viewing or playing. You know, this is which in fact you might do also while you're reading it. But you know, that's one perspective on this, and that doesn't just encompass the static documents that we're used to thinking about in print culture, but all sorts of dynamic systems that produce things that you can read and that may take inputs from you based on what you write or on how you click or on any other mode of interaction. So this, when we look through actually nine different, maybe we should move on to this.
The last thing was we wanted to try and make sure that not only were these things runnable, but they were runnable in a cross-platform way. And now on to the examples.
We're going to look at nine things, not all of which are examples of electronic literature, but I think they all hold lessons for electronic literature, and we're going to sort of focus on these. Actually, we're not going to look at all nine of them. We're going to look at fewer, but I'll at least skim through some of this. But we did hand out copies of the CD contents, so if there are questions about any particular challenges related to works or any particular works that you know of that you want to inquire about, we'll leave some time for that, we hope. To start off with, might as well begin chronologically back in the 1960s. And Space War is generally considered the first modern video game. There was computer gaming that happened before this, but Space War was real time, involved two players, and it's known to a wider culture because of Stuart Brand's article about it in 1976 in Rolling Stone also. But it was tremendously influential, and thanks to the efforts, which some of you I saw reading about and nodding at on the screen here, thanks to the efforts of some people at MIT, the original source code of this was typed in, 40 pages of it, and then they wrote a PDP-1 assembler using Perl, and then they wrote a PDP-1 emulator. So they have a software computer that acts like a PDP-1. It's written in Java, and as a result, we can actually fire up Space War. Man, I'm not even going to be able to...
The podium's in your way.
Yeah, that was a rather uninteresting game. But that's the type of thing when you when you work as a new media editor, that's the sort of computer game player you rapidly become. So, in more interesting sessions of this game, people would be able to see something and sense something of what it was like to experience this particular computer program. There are plenty of limitations that this system has. It is not on a vector scope, which the PDP-1 originally had. They actually changed the size of the spaceship because it seemed too big on this in this particular mode of presentation. But the behavior of it is the same. You can see how gravity worked as it was modeled in this system. The missiles didn't have they didn't actually have enough computation left in a cycle to compute gravity for the missiles, only for the spaceships. So, of course, those just became photon torpedoes or something that, you know, didn't obey gravity. But you get a better idea from looking at this, or certainly one that complements, you know, just reading an article about what space war is. Now, as you see, there's a lot of effort went into this by people who I happen to know, some of them, but they didn't do this because of the New Media Reader. They just put this project together for kicks. This is a case where an emulator was written specifically to be able to run Space War, but it's a very important part of our culture, being representative of the beginning of video games. So, and another news from the 1960s that was going on around the same time at MIT. There's a system by Joseph Weizenbaum called ELIZA. And it's a system that runs a very famous script that allows it to impersonate a Rogerian psychotherapist. Here is a Java implementation of this. Not very legible, but hello, how do you do? Please state your problem. You say you seem to really suck at Space War. Yes, perhaps I need more time to practice. You seem to be quite positive. So, this is a sort of, Weizenbaum actually said it was more of a parody of a Rogerian psychotherapist than an impersonation of one. But the way that this happened to be on the CD is that Charles Hayden re-implemented, this is not any of this is Weizenbaum's original code, but it's a re-implementation based on access to his code, which was written in a Lisp dialect, and to documentation of what it did in academic papers that, you know, very specifically defined the function of different portions of this program, and was a good enough specification to be able to actually re-implement this. Now, this is a system that there's several ways in which this is unrealistic, and I wonder if anyone can think of perhaps the most outrageous sort of violation on the material level that we might have in presenting this. What's that?
It's written.
Oh, but originally, I'm talking about the original ELIZA didn't have a speech interface. You typed to it. But you didn't type and look at a computer screen. You used a teletype. So actually, early electronic literature, although it's not discussed very often, was on paper with ink. And ELIZA is an example. So, this is something that, again, to understand how it is the program functions and what it's like formally, which is an important aspect of the analysis here. This is not only about the materiality of this work that we are concerned with, but also about what it actually does, what its functionality is. You can use a re-implementation like this to learn about that in the actual process of, you know, entering inputs and seeing what it says back. So this is a good way to complement something like, you know, Sherry Turkle's writing. Mm-hmm.
I need to see one more response from the light. I wasn't noticing it on the screen, but I remember when we did it on a teletype, that part of the fun of the experience was that it came out one letter at a time. I was wondering what Eliza was going to say next.
Yeah.
Do that.
No, we can see. I mean, the answer probably is that everything always comes out one letter at a time, but,
yeah,
you know, but extremely quickly. Yeah, rather quick. Yeah. So that's an issue that, you know, there would be various ways to address that. But the other thing is, you know, sort of it's sort of like someone who, you know, being aware of how a teletype works, and then, you know, provides you some information about the materiality of that experience. And having a re-implementation provides you some information about how this work actually functions, right? So, you know, this is one piece of putting that together for study, or for having fun, you know, typing things into Eliza. So some of the other issues we encountered, I mean, there's another timing issue that we tried to deal with in an approximate way. We include two basic programs. One of them is Hunt the Wumpus, which I know is near and dear to Noah's heart.
Basic, the computer language, not basic in terms of functionality.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Beginner's all-purpose symbolic instruction code style basic. And the other is Judy Malloy's U, which is originally installed in a museum. People could come in, type things that they would say to a lover, and they would be concatenated in different ways to make a sort of long text that might be a dialogue, or it might somehow describe the arc of a relationship. Interestingly, in this case, you know, Hunt the Wumpus, the version that we had, which was not the original code, but again, which implemented it in a way that was authentic, was written in a standard basic dialect, and we were able to simply drop it in so that people on Mac and PC using the basic interpreters that we included could run it. Judy Malloy's piece had specific invocations, which when we essentially I ported this program to the dialect of BASIC that we were able to include for both platforms, but there's sound that's in the original that's just that code is commented out. You can go and see it, but it doesn't do anything in the BASIC dialect we used. And there was a means of timing that simply, you know, waited a certain number of iterations through a loop that were based on a you know, the particular speed of the machine that was used in that museum, which there are actually ways to slow down your processor, and this is, you know, this is something that comes up for computer game companies who are doing sequels to, you know, Ultima that you know, started back in the 1980s, actually 79, I think, but. So these are things that that some people deal with.
And these are going to continue to be best practices issues for electronic literature authors. You know, if you author in a standard dialect of a programming language, people are going to be much more likely to be able to preserve and carry forward your work than if you use some weird little dialect that only runs on a particular machine from a particular vendor. So yeah. It's, you know, it's an issue that came up for Hunt the Wumpus, which is close to my heart because it was the first new media experience I had playing Hunt the Wumpus on the university mainframe. But it will come up over and over again because electronic literature, you know, like in some level we do have standard ways of specifying interaction and behavior. Those standard ways are called computer languages and, you know, programming languages. And when you use ones that are standard and well defined and implemented on a lot of platforms, we're able to carry them forward better.
Yeah, and actually a very good example of that is one of the selections that is from the 1970s on the CD, or beginning one selection from the 1970s and actually one from 93. The Interactive Fiction Works that we have on here are Adventure, written in 75 and 76. This is actually, again, not the original, actually the very original code for Adventure that Will Crowther wrote before it was modified by Don Woods, it's not known to still exist. I mean, perhaps it does, but lots of people have made inquiries, and no one seems to have found it. Don Wood's original version, however, is after he made his modification, and that became the canonical version, is one of the most widely available computer programs in the world. And the implementation that we have is done in the Z machine. I'll talk some more tomorrow about interpreters and how it is that they allow massively cross-platform works like this to be made fairly easily. But Adventure and Graham Nelson's Curses that he did in 93 were good examples of works that we were just able to drop in. Everything was available for free, the work itself, the interpreters, and due to the efforts not only of Will Crowther, Don Woods, and Graham Nelson, but also a tremendous number of people, ranging from Joel Barrez at Infocom, who originally developed the Z machine standard, to the people who later reverse engineered it, to the people who wrote these particular interpreters that we included. Actually, the interpreters we included are ports of earlier work that someone else did. But because all of this was done for free, it could be done building on other people's work rather than doing it from scratch. One case where we chose not to actually do a emulation. Now, actually, we present several Atari games running in emulation. A different Adventure, although inspired by Crowther's, does not contain any text except in a semiotic sense. Missile Command and Yar's Revenge. But in the case of Star Raiders, Star Raiders used a controller that came with it and was, I think, not used for almost anything else except Star Raiders. So there's a special piece of hardware that you had to have on the Atari 2600. And now, actually, the Atari 2600 version was not the original. It's a port of the Atari 800 version. And this is a fairly influential piece of computer gaming that Brenda Laurel wrote about in her PhD thesis, and we include that excerpt in the book. But it seemed like it would be exceedingly unwieldy, not only for us to put something that functioned on here, but also for the average interested reader, even someone who cared about video games and wanted to experience these, to actually try to work it. So instead, we simply used. We simply provided some documentation, and just to give an example of that's the cover of Star Raiders. This is a video clip of a Xylon attack. See on your Atari 400. No, it's just a video clip. But just to, one point of interest is that I asked some guy on the internet who I've never met to do this video capture for me, and he did, and we have it on the CD because of that. So, it's the goodwill of people who are interested in this material that's going to allow us to document it. It's something that you can do with infinite time, but you need other people to help out in practice.
Speaking of infinite time, just last 1 more minute before we
have a discussion. Yeah, maybe I'm wondering if there's. Time for two more works for us to show briefly, one of which is... I'm cutting out all the elit and just showing the video games, by the way. one of them is Jordan Mechner's Karateka, which is... excellent cinematically inspired.
Before Prince of Persia.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, Prince of Persia is 89, I believe. And Jordan Meschner is sort of the Stanley Kubrick of video game development. He comes out with a game every 5 years, you know. What's that? Not in this part, but I believe they're actually. I think music comes in after that. Yeah. Among other things, you know what a cutscene is in video games? Yeah, this is Veronica's. That's one bit of Veronica. I mean, if they weren't, someone should let me know. But I think they were. Yeah. But specifically, I need to switch to keyboard. There we go. But anyway, that's a little. That's a little taste of what Karatek is like. I'm not gonna let you see my demise this time. All right, and so we included an Apple II emulator and several works for the Apple II, some of which we asked permission for. Mystery House, the first text and graphics adventure game, was placed in the public domain by its creators 10 years after it was made. Yeah.
The Williams.
Yes, yeah, Ken and Roberta Williams. So, the last thing. That we'd like to mention here. Many of you know of the work of, I'm in the 90s already. Many of you know of the work of William Dickey, who did some very intriguing early work in HyperCard. And there have been several sort of plans to publish his work. He died in 94. But although Dina Larson has put in a tremendous amount of effort to prepare it for publication, this is actually the first publication beyond the distribution on floppy disk that Bill Dickey did at the time, that this work has seen. So maybe we just look briefly at a piece of homosexual erotica. That, in fact, this is something that I think wasn't even really known that people who were familiar with his HyperCard poetry didn't know that he had done this work, and he has two other pieces like it. Oh, yeah, I could do that. Oh, yeah, well, one thing that you actually have to, the way to move forward, there's certain places you have to click. let's see. Here. Yeah. But, yeah, the fact that the links are concealed is done in a somewhat interesting way, I think, in this work. And there's not, as far as I am aware, multiple pathways through it. But that process of discovering, you know, what's a link is an interesting one in this piece. And you know, one of the issues that came up is. We requested from Apple that we be able to include the HyperCard player, which is distributed free by Apple. Simply what you need to look at a HyperCard stack. And they said no, we couldn't include the HyperCard player. So we had to build a standalone application.
Each of the stacks.
Yeah.
So each of the stacks had to be converted into a standalone application for inclusion on the CD because we were denied the use of the HyperCard player, which right. I think many of us in this community had just assumed was a piece of abandonware. It's not.
Yeah. Or even without assuming that,
right.
that Apple would never prevent anyone from distributing
right.
it because all it does is let other people look at the work you did
right.
using their product. What's that? No.
No, we got back a letter saying, yes, you can use the Apple II ROM. No, you can't use the HyperCard player. And that was it, you know.
Yeah. So this is just, I mean, and we had, there were two other people who, in different cities, who helped us to build these things into actual HyperCard applications. So not to mention the fact that, you know, Dina had already done work beforehand to actually, you know, finish up some of the technical work in editing these. That's a lot of people who are involved, and so maybe I'll just wrap up this and ask if there's any other questions about some of the practical matters of making this stuff available.
Or you can ask anything you want.